You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Around the world, agricultural land is being bought up at accelerating rates by global investors, by governments as well as corporations. For some countries with capital but without secure agricultural land, it's an investment to avoid food riots. For other firms, it's a chance to profit off increasing commodity prices. Attention has mostly been paid to this phenomenon as it's taking place in poor countries. Little discussion has focused on the global land rush as it is playing out right here in Canada. Melanie Somerville is a doctoral student in geography at the University of British Columbia. She's the co-author of the article Land Rush in the most recent issue of Briar Patch magazine. And Melanie joins me today in our studio. Hi, Melanie.
Hi.
What are investors looking to the Canadian, why are they looking to the Canadian prairies in particular for large-scale land deals?
Well, I think there's a couple of different factors. So one is that the price of prairie farmland is actually quite competitive, not just within the country, but also globally. So in the past few years, because there's been so much increased interest in farmland investment, we've seen some kind of global metrics develop to help rank different areas against each other in terms of cost and some other factors too. And it looks like Saskatchewan is very affordable relative to even places that you might think of as having cheaper land, like many locations in South America, for example. Saskatchewan farmland is a real bargain relative to Brazil. And certainly relative to other, you know, similarly developed countries like the U.S. or the U.K., for example. So, yeah.
So it's a good deal.
It's a good deal. I mean, a lot of it is based on the price. Of course, you know, if you talk to investment analysts, they think that the farmland is very good quality farmland. You know, with more regular access to water than many parts of the world, certainly. So, you know, those are other factors. I think because farmland is very, you know, affordable on the prairies right now, part of the reason for that affordability is because we have fairly strict legislation at the provincial level in the prairie provinces that help to keep that price down. But I think a lot of investors are anticipating and indeed pushing for those regulations to be loosened. And, you know, farmland ownership legislation to be liberalized, basically, and sort of counting on a dramatic increase in farmland prices if and when that happens.
So a bit of land speculation going on.
Precisely, yeah, speculating that the regulations will be changed in their favor. So
now there are two major ways, I understand, that large investors are acquiring farmland, one of them being farmland investment funds. What does that model look like?
That's right. So we have a few different investment funds that have emerged, say, over the last decade. Three of them, really: Assiniboine, Ag Capita, and Bonafield. And they essentially, what they do is they allow private investors to kind of buy into a limited partnership model, and they pool that investment, those investment funds together to purchase large areas of farmland, usually over a fairly, broad geographic region, so as to lessen their exposure to weather-related risks, because of course that's a really big issue for farmers. And so investors pool their money, they buy into these, and then they usually return, a set dividend, for example, to investors based on how much they've contributed. So
it's a little bit like investing in mutual funds or something like that, where they diversify their portfolio and they buy it as a group.
Precisely. Now, one important thing to note about that is they actually do, I mean, they acquire the farmland, but typically these companies are not that involved in actual agricultural production on the farmland. So they usually buy the farmland and then lease it back to farmers. And sometimes the farmers that they're leasing it back to are actually the farmers that they bought it from. So from the farmer's perspective, this is a way to, get new capital into farming. Capital is, hard to come by in farming. And for the investor, it's, a chance to profit off of land appreciation.
Okay.
Basically.
So then it sounds like farmers who at one time own their own land are then selling that land to capitalize their farming operations.
Right.
And then And then, but then the control of the land and the ownership of the land goes to an investment firm.
That's right. And in some ways, it's not new. I mean, certainly on the prairies, it's been increasingly common for farmers to lease a portion of their land as opposed to owning it. But what's different is that normally they would be, I mean, traditionally, they've really been leasing it from other members of their rural communities who have exited farming. This brings a whole different spectrum of investors into it. Often, you know, investors who are both more spatially distant, so, you know, maybe living in Toronto or places farther away, but also who are potentially more socially distant, you know, who are not as integrated into rural communities.
So. Now, the other main model that you look at is corporate farming ventures, and tell us about your farm, the research that you did on One Earth Farms. What do they do?
That's right. So this is really the main focus of my doctoral research, is looking at One Earth Farms. And again, it's a bit of a different model. So One Earth Farms was started in 2009 by a company called Sprott Resource Corporation, which is publicly traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So it's a publicly traded corporation. So, you know, investors can just buy stocks in Sprott Resource Corporation and thereby get exposure to One Earth Farms. So it's a bit different than buying into like a limited partnership model, which is what we saw in the farmland investment funds model. And then basically they profit off of, Sprott has a history of not paying dividends on its stock, but they just profit off of the, you know, rises in the value of the stock on the stock market, essentially. And another key difference with that model is that One Earth Farms is involved in agricultural production. So, you know, they produce crops, grains and oilseeds, specialty crops like legumes and forages, and also range-fed beef, so cattle, on their lands as well. So it's a bit different. And we actually have a third model that's brand new. It's not, you know, totally clear where this is going to go, I guess. But Bonafield, one of the firms that has had a farmland investment fund, has recently started a different model, another publicly traded firm, which will similarly allow people to buy stock. It'll be traded, you know, on a stock exchange, probably the TSX again, and will allow people to buy stock in that to access farmland. I think the key difference between Bonafield and One Earth Farms is that so far One Earth Farms, the vast majority of their farming is done on First Nations reserves. So they operate in partnership with First Nations, and I don't think that Bonafield will go in that direction.
And how do the why do the First Nations opt to join these partnerships with One Earth Farms rather than just start their own farming operations independently?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question to ask in this circumstance. And there's lots of different reasons. We have, unfortunately, a fairly shameful colonial history on the prairies of really actively both dispossessing First Nations of their land, but also sort of aggressively excluding them from being able to participate in agriculture on any commercial scale. And in recent years, there's been fairly substantial land claim settlements on the prairies. And so in some provinces, that's resulted in transfers of crown land. In others, it's more financial settlements through which First Nations can then buy land. So, you know, land holdings have increased quite substantially, but there's, I guess, First Nations, there's a lot of barriers to them actually employing that land into commercial agriculture. You know, oftentimes, because of the historical exclusion, they don't have the skills to farm as modern farmers. They don't have the same kind of access to capital. So that's, you know, a key thing that a group like Sprott Resource Corporation can bring in. They have trouble accessing credit because land on First Nations reserves is communally held, right? So it can't be leveraged at the bank the same way, privately held property could. And historically, they've really had trouble accessing subsidies from the government for agriculture, which is really key to keeping prairie farming alive. That's mostly because subsidies have been paid out based on income tax returns. And First Nations, of course, don't pay income tax. So, you know, they can't access those key supports. So, you know, for them, partnering with a company like One Earth Farms promises to bring them skills and training, jobs, lower risk exposure, because if you are farming independently and you don't have access, for example, to government-funded crop insurance, then it's a big hit if you lose your crop to hail. And, you know, it's not uncommon for drought and hail, things like that, to affect farming on the prairies. So there's lots of different reasons.
What do you think? Why should we be concerned about this trend, both for the corporate investment in land and also models like One Earth Farms that 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 conduct these large farming operations?
Well, I think one of the things that concerns me most is that right now it seems to be happening in a very sort of ad hoc and disorganized way. You know, there has been, as you mentioned in the lead, and there's been considerable attention to this issue globally. And we've certainly seen other countries starting to consider, countries who don't have, you know, land ownership regulations, starting to consider inserting them, you know, talking about farmland as a strategic asset for a country, which then opens up a lot of questions about who should own that farmland exactly. Should it be Canadian farmers? Should it be Canadians in general? Can foreign investors be allowed in? That sort of thing. And I think it's partly because this issue is regulated at the provincial level. So, you know, each province is kind of doing its own thing. In many provinces, such as BC, we don't even have, you know, ownership regulations. And we don't have a clear image of who owns farmland in this province. So, you know, I think that's really the big concern for me, is that there's a need for a lot more information than we have right now. And I think there's a real need to consider this in a more careful, studied, thorough way than we've been looking at the issue so far.
What do you think the long-term impact of this overall trend will be for the livelihoods of these First Nations you were talking about, and also of small farmers?
Yeah. Well, I'm hopeful that with First Nations, it results in more. I know a key goal for them is really obtaining more economic self-sufficiency, but then that's also linked to political self-determination opportunities as well. And I certainly they're hopeful, and, you know, I share that hope that really will result for them. It's kind of, there's a big resource boom on the prairies right now, not just around agriculture, but potash, oil and gas. These are huge emerging industries. And so there's lots of investment interest and attention in First Nations land and resources. And this is really one of the first kind of corporate Indigenous partnerships we've seen emerge. So it's potentially a really important testing ground, I think, to see you know, what an effective model looks like, how First Nations can get a fair share of the benefits, because I think that really future deals will be modeled on One Earth Farms. So, you know, I'm hopeful that the implications from a First Nations perspective are positive. The implications of a model like One Earth Farms for other non-native farmers it's a bit challenging, because a lot of that land that First Nations are now leasing to One Earth Farms was previously leased to non-native farmers in the community who have now lost some of their land base. So there's some interesting sort of secondary effects with that model. With the farmland investment funds more generally, you know, there's potentially, we raise in the article some potential in ecological and also social considerations. So these farming operations tend to implement a very large-scale, input-intensive approach to agriculture. And that might leave the sector, you know, it certainly leaves it more vulnerable to things like peak oil and, you know, rising fossil fuel costs. So from an ecological, they're farming very large areas using very heavy farm machinery, so it leads to concerns potentially about soil compaction and erosion and things like this. From a social side, you know, as I mentioned, this is really a new, you know, a more socially distant investor that's looking to get involved and take a portion of the profits that would otherwise go to farmers. It extracts capital, really, from rural communities that would otherwise circulate within those communities. And I think there's quite a bit of concern around what that could do to sort of the rural fabric or the social fabric in rural areas of the prairies.
So they sound like very big issues. Is there a place where these discussions should be taking place? Is that something that should be happening in the federal government? Like, what?
I think that the federal government will likely hesitate to get involved, because this is really in the jurisdiction of the provinces. And we also seem to have a federal government right now who really believes in devolving things to the provinces. So certainly, I think this is something that needs to be happening at the provincial government level. It is happening a lot in civil society already. I mean, there's been tremendous media attention, even quite a bit of media attention in Canada to, you know, in the investment press and the farm press. And Grain, a Canadian, and well, they're an international NGO, but their main researcher, Devlin Koyuk, who works on these issues, is located in Montreal. So we have a great resource here that we can use. They've set up a website, www.farmlandgrab.org, where people can basically post articles about the farmland, you know, farmland rush globally. And they've actually won the Right Livelihood Awards as sort of the alternative Nobel for their work around that. So, you know, they've really been a key. That's I think, a key learning resource, going to their website and reading their publications about it.
It's been excellent talking with you this morning. Thank you for coming.
Thanks. It's great. And to talk about my research.
I've been speaking with Melanie Somerville. Melanie's a doctoral student in geography at the University of British Columbia, and she wrote the article Land Grab in Briar Patch magazine. If you would like more information, as she says, on the global land grab, you can visit the online resource farmlandgrab.org.